Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Come to Los Angeles. The sun shines bright, the beaches are wide and inviting, and the orange grove stretches far as the eye can see.
The sun shines and the land may be cheap, but if you've seen L.A. Confidential, or just about any movie set in the City of Angels, you know it's a town with a dark side. This week's Film Spotting Top 5, Los Angeles Movies.
I like how your voice went a little lower there on dark side. Of course, Hollywood has already had its top 5 close up here on the show, so as you start compiling your own list, focus on non-movie-related L.A. stories. It's tough to do, but that's where we're going with our list. We'll also review the new cop thriller End of Watch, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña.
All that and more on Film Spotting. Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. Cue up the Randy Newman. Our top 5 LA movies are coming up later in the show, along with our contemporary Iranian Cinema Marathon Awards.
But first, what happens when you put Training Day scribe David Ayer behind a camera? Cops.
I am Police Officer 2, Brian Taylor. This is my partner, Officer Zavala.
I'm in my chonies.
I know, dude. Come on.
I'm in my chonies. No.
Come on, man.
We were basic patrol here in Newton. One of the toughest divisions in the LAPD.
Take pride in what you do, you guys.
Yes, sir.
I got him. Try to run.
Pit him, man.
You know, I see you guys out here being good little company, man. It's all fun and games. You get to run and jump and fight and shoot.
I'm down with that.
Watch your six.
The Fast and the Furious, Training Day, Dark Blue, SWAT, Street Kings. Filmmaker David Ayer has written or directed each of these movies about police officers, all of which I believe have been set in Los Angeles. End of Watch, his latest, is about two beat cops, played by Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña, patrolling, yes, South Central Los Angeles. What new could Ayer possibly bring to this material? End of Watch is distinct, however, in the way Ayer takes a found footage approach to the story. Much of the material is recorded via squad car cams, surveillance devices, or the various cameras Gyllenhaal's officer Brian Taylor carries on him as part of some vaguely defined project. The technique certainly sets End of Watch apart. It's a bit like watching the Paranormal Activity folks tackling a police drama.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if it really elevates this familiar material. Was it engrossing for you, Adam, or did it feel like an extended episode of Cops?
Yeah, it's hard not to make the Cops comparison here, though. It's been quite a long time since I can recall actually watching.
Sitting down for a good afternoon
episode
to Cops.
Of Cops. I'm not saying I've never done it before, but it's certainly been a while. The found footage technique here is something I'm still wrestling with, frankly, because the fact is I feel like that found footage conceit, besides making me a little bit queasy in the beginning, seems maybe in general a little bit tired. So it wasn't an aspect of the film that I was really looking forward to or really won me over early on. And the fact is, it's really inconsistently employed. The whole conceit of it with Brian Taylor, Jake Gyllenhaal's character, shooting this class project. He has to take a arts credit, he explains at one point, so he's going to make a film.
And I don't even know if he was serious about that.
Yeah,
you couldn't
hard.
Even tell if that was just a joke.
It's hard to really know. And the fact is, we get a lot of shots that don't come from the perspective of a squad car camera or one of the cameras they've attached to their uniform or the camera he's carrying. So at some point, you're wondering, okay, who's now holding that camera? And it does bring you out of the film a little bit. That said, there is an aspect of the found footage technique that did really work for me. And I think we'll get into a lot of various aspects of this film that both didn't work and worked quite well. Ultimately, I'm coming down positive on the side of this film, Josh. And one of the reasons I am is that I think when I consider the found footage approach. I think it does work well to heighten the tension in a lot of scenes, as it does in a lot of action movies when you have that shaky cam. But more than anything, from the opening sequence of the film, that really is all from that perspective of the camera in the squad car while they're on a chase, and it ends with some gunfire. It's a very harrowing sequence to open a film with. It sets up this notion that you're watching not an episode of Cops, but you're watching a video game. It's from the perspective of that first-person shooter.
Yeah, very
and
much.
And I think that what he might be suggesting here, what David Ayer might be playing with a little bit here, is this idea that it's so easy to get lost in this video game-type perspective and to not consider the reality of what cops go through on a daily basis, and even as a viewer, to look at it as though it's fake, to not consider the consequences of some of your actions. I think early in this film, we certainly see that these characters don't really completely appreciate the consequences of their actions and are maybe a little too cavalier with it. And so in some ways, by heightening the artifice, I think David Ayer manages to subvert the notion of the artificiality of the video game rather than reinforce it.
I think that's a lot of work. That's gone a long way to justifying what's really a distracting technique for me here. I agree that the movie does humanize the police officers, but for me, that was all in the performances and the acting, mm-hmm. which I'm sure we'll get to. But as far as this found footage approach, I really feel it's a fatal mistake for this film. For one reason, this isn't Paul Greengrass we've got here, director of the two really good Bourne films, where there's a precision behind the technique. I didn't find very much precision here at all. So despite the chaotic nature of what's going on here, I know that's what the movie is going for. It's supposed to be capturing chaos, but you still need discipline in order to do that. There are a lot of scenes here where you can't even tell what's happening in some of the fight scenes or the action scenes. The other problem, which you touched on, is that it isn't consistent. Where is this footage coming from? A lot of it, we do see the source, but then we'll get a shot where we wonder, now, what camera is this? In particular, towards the end, in the climax, we get a shot looking up the barrel of Gyllenhaal's gun right at his face. And it's clear the camera's attached to the barrel of the shotgun because it swings around. Mm-hmm. We have never had an indication that he has a camera there. So that's distracting. And I really found that it was forced in a lot of instances. There are shots of these gangbangers who kind of make up the main villains, and they're carrying around home movie right. cameras too.
In the car, when they're just drinking and talking.
Maybe they would do that. I mean, I don't know, but it certainly doesn't seem to be natural in the film. And maybe the most ridiculous aspect of this is at one point near the end, there's a random sequence where the head of a drug cartel, we assume is supposed to be in Mexico, we see through these night vision goggles, and the guy looks exactly like Juan Valdez. It's just this completely ridiculous, stereotypical image. And we're wondering now, whose camera is this? I think they might eventually even put some text
on
there.
No, they do. It's up there the whole time. And I think that's the bigger problem, is that it actually says like the Department of Immigration or something. And you wonder, okay, if someone's watching this, who's watching this footage
exactly.
and gathering it?
Another
and
very forced use of the technique.
Why are they notifying someone in the L.A. Police Department about this?
Exactly.
Reload. Partner!
Dude!
Partner!
Bro! You all good?
Yeah.
Some big evil in the army.
Yeah.
We can't hold them off. We gotta lay on our base of fire and pivot.
What the f*** does that mean, dude?
We're shooting our way out of here, bro.
Can these fools get out?
Yeah, we got these motherfuckers, homie. These ain't going nowhere.
Z, look at me, okay. All right? Look at me.
Okay.
On three, dude. You're gonna empty your mag and run.
Okay.
You ready?
Okay.
One, two, three.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We're talking about the new film from the writer of Training Day. It's called End of Watch. It's interesting, though, that you accuse the movie of not being precise enough. And I know where you're going. We agree in terms of the inconsistency of that technique. But another problem I had with the film is actually that I think it's a little bit too precise for a dirty found footage movie. And what I mean is in terms of the overall storytelling, sometimes pieces just fit together a little too neatly. An example of that would be almost every conversation that Michael Peña and Jake Gyllenhaal have in their car together will be so perfectly timed where they're laughing and having a good time, and there's kind of a punchline to a joke, and then just as they finish the joke, dispatch comes on and says they have to be somewhere. So it's all just really perfectly calibrated. A bigger example of that, a more egregious example of that, would be a little bit later in the film when we see a group of black men talking. And they're waxing a little bit philosophical, one of them is anyway, about the history of this neighborhood
in LA,
and the fact that now it's all Mexican and we have to watch our backs or else we're going to be extinct. He literally says, or else we're going to be extinct right as members of a Mexican gang open up fire on them.
They also have a camcorder in that scene, too. Like,
they have
towards
a camcorder
the end,
there
he
too.
Says, hey, put that camera away to remind us that the camera's there.
Sometimes I actually felt like, as I said, it was a little bit too neatly put together. And as I suggested earlier, I could certainly go on about the things that don't work with this movie. We'll get to some of them, surely. But I do want to focus on what did work for me, because obviously I'm in a different place with you at the end of this film. And it really has to do with those performances. And I want to single out all the really good actors here in smaller roles that I think are very good and really drew me into this world, made me care about these characters. Cody Horn, who we saw in Magic Mike as the love interest in that film. She's a young cop. America Ferrara, very good. Frank Grillo, who I believe we last saw in Warrior. Natalie Martinez, David Harbour. These people aren't necessarily household names, but very talented and do great work here. Ultimately, though, this is Michael Peña and Jake Gyllenhaal's movie. They appear in almost every scene. And I just got to say, honestly, can they just star in every movie ever made for the rest of time? That's how much, Josh. That's how much I enjoy.
They're good, but that might get a little old.
No, I think I can handle it. They're that good. And I've been on record as loving Michael Peña for a long time. And Gyllenhaal is slowly but surely earning that same respect for me in terms of being a Michael Peña type of actor, someone who can accomplish a lot while being very understated. And you get that in some of these moments here, some of the quieter moments in this film, where a dramatic moment, an emotional moment is punctuated with a simple nod of your head or a turn of your head or nothing at all, just letting the moment breathe. These are actors who really, really know what they're doing and are directed well. And maybe I'm just a sucker for that cop banter, but from the moment you meet them, you buy them as cops.
Yep.
You buy them as partners who have that shorthand with each other where they can finish each other's sentences. They know the other person better than they know themselves. And that dynamic comes through so strong here, Josh, that it compensates for all the movie's other sins. For me, really, that's what carried this film, including the humor of the scenes that they have together.
I really wanted it to. Trust me, I was rooting for them. And it really is it's a singular performance in a lot of ways. I don't think you can separate either one of them, and you can't say that Gyllenhaal would have been just as good without Peña's. I mean, they play off each other. The timing is right. Mm-hmm. All the things you mentioned is perfect. The humor.
You should marry one of my cousins.
If they're anything like you, I wouldn't be able to stand an hour with them. Waking up in the morning, they'd be like,
hey, can I tell you a story?
I know.
Here's a story about this, and a story about that, and a story about this, a story about that.
But dude, all you gotta do is this. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, uh-huh, yeah.
You want to come to my cousin's quinceañera, my daughter's quinceañera, my brother's quinceañera.
Yeah.
My sister's quinceañera.
There's always something happening, though, bro. It's better than, like, hey, do you know the new kind of flavored coffee I have?
Oh,
do you like
really?
This kind of coffee? The baristas are excellent.
You like coffee, dude. Don't give me that.
I like good Starbucks coffee.
Whatever. I'll let you lay into me. Lay into me, dude. Fine.
Gyllenhaal, I mean, Peña's always been funny. Gyllenhaal's really funny in this film. So I completely agree with you on that. But I've got to say, those scenes of the two of them are so at odds with the overall aesthetic that this picture is going for that I just couldn't forgive the rest of the stuff going on here. And the thing that stood out to me is that all of these great conversation scenes, especially the one about marriage, I think that might have been my favorite, where there's maybe a 5-minute scene where they're talking
great
back
writing,
and forth.
Great acting.
It really is. Notice, though, in that scene, how static the camera is.
Right. And at the end of the film, in the most heightened moments, the camera becomes more conventionally Hollywood and is very static.
But it's static in the conversation scenes, and I think that's important because those are clearly the best scenes. So if you're overwhelming your movie with this style, yet the strongest scenes are the ones without that style, I just can't forgive the dependence on it. And I also want to go back to some of the supporting cast you mentioned, especially America Ferrara and Cody Horn. When I saw their faces early on, I was really encouraged, too, because Ferrara, I've been impressed with for a long time since Real Women Have Curves, and she's also known for TV's Ugly Betty. We talked about Cody Horn with Magic Mike, how much promise she showed in that film. So I thought, wow, this is going to be really rich. Those were completely token roles for me. They showed up here and there. They hardly got a full scene where they were anything more than responding to what else happened. And just given the promise of those two actresses, I really was disappointed on that end.
Well, there's no doubt, Josh, that they don't have major roles in this film. It is the story of these two cops, but I feel like they do add something to every scene that they're in. I really did get a lot out of their performances, especially when you consider it in this larger context. And as much of a cop movie cliche as it is, one of the things that really comes through here is that notion of the police force being this extended family. And so I felt like at some point they were kind of like family members with these cops. They weren't people who were always around them, but nevertheless, they had that same kind of sense of humor. They could volley things back and forth. And you're right, they don't have major roles, but I still thought they brought something to the table. And to get back real quick to the notion that you can't get past of the found footage aesthetic, it's worth noting, I just scribbled this in my notes, that you know you're having a problem possibly as a filmmaker and as a screenwriter when the most common phrase that's used in the film, it comes up over and over again, is get that camera out of my face. It must be said 17 times in this movie as a way, I'm guessing, to add some verisimilitude, to make you aware of the camera, that there's something a little bit odd that people are filming in these situations. So let's call attention to it and have the person say, shut that off. Definitely. Why are you doing this? But actually, it does get a little bit annoying. There's no doubt about it. In terms of other things that I could use as strikes against this movie, it does trade in a lot of cliches, I think, in terms of race and its portrayal of Mexicans and blacks and these gangs and how those races are coexisting or not coexisting in this part of LA without really being interested at all in how we got there. Mm-hmm. It's not really interested in any kind of historical context or really even understanding what the dynamic is today. It's all just backdrop.
I thought the villains were pretty cartoonish.
Yeah, it's
too.
Really just there to serve this story of these buddy cops.
Yeah.
And so I'll also say that the end of the film, without giving anything away, it does, for better or worse, commit one of my cardinal sins. And I'll just describe it this way. Every filmmaker has a card they can play to get its audience to feel like we've been through something really heavy and emotional and profound. And Ayer plays it. And my head wants to reject it for that reason, because I recognize it as something I am fundamentally against and tend to recoil from in other films. But I think those films just aren't as well made as this film and aren't as well written. And I think that Ayer does know this environment so well. And I don't know his background. I didn't do any research. But clearly, he's got a fascination with the L.A. Police Department and L.A. in terms of just its street violence. He directed the film Harsh Times, which takes place in South Central and deals with gangs as well. So clearly, he knows this subject matter. And because he knows it so well, that makes up for a lot of the problems. And as much as my head is going against it, my heart actually followed along completely where he was trying to take me.
Are you talking about the fire scene?
I'm not talking about the fire scene. I'm talking about the end of the film.
Oh,
the ultimate
okay.
climax of
okay.
the film, which
the
obviously I don't
climax.
Want to get
yeah,
into
yeah,
too many
no,
details about.
We should.
But you bring up a scene in the movie that plays a really pivotal role, actually, where I don't think we're spoiling anything to say the two cops put themselves in a lot of danger to mm-hmm. kind of be heroes. And I actually love the fact that one of the things Ayer does, this is another one of those quiet moments, those truthful moments that come through in this film. He takes the time to show them have a conversation where one of the characters says, you know, we're being recognized as heroes, but all I did was follow you.
Right.
I just did what you were doing. Because you're my partner, and really I was worried about you more than anything. I'm not this heroic cop that some people are making me out to be. I love that moment.
It's a very good scene, and notice it's also a very static shot. I mean, they're in
another
a convenience
one, right.
store at the time. I don't even think he bothers to use the convenience store security camera, which, given the rest of the film, I could see him doing. It's just a traditional shot, letting the actors do really good work. You know what a lot of this movie actually reminded me of, and maybe it's because we've been looking back at his career recently, but a Tony Scott film that was made with less expensive equipment.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't have that sheen or that polish, but it has that same sort of chaotic sensibility that doesn't always work in favor of the narrative.
It doesn't always work, but sometimes it doesn't really detract from the story enough either. And I think that that's what happens here. It happens for me with some Tony Scott films as well. So a little bit of a disagreement on End of Watch. It's out now in wide release. It opened this weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Adam and I will run the good cop, bad cop routine next in Massacre Theater and recognize the standout scenes, performances, and more from our recent contemporary Iranian cinema marathon. Stay with us.
I must have left 1,000 times. But every day begins the same. 'Cause there's a small town in my mind.
It's audiobook recommendation time as we share this message from our great partners over at audible.com. They're the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod.
You can listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible has it covered.
And we start with this recommendation from a listener. Love to feature listener Audible recommendations on the show. Sean Lockhart wrote in, Josh, he heard our discussion about my son Holden, how he has discovered The Hobbit after seeing the trailer.
Lucky kid.
For that Peter Jackson film, and went back home and immediately started reading the book. So Sean has some other recommendations that Holden might find interesting, that I may find interesting. He says, I don't know if you're reading to your brood or not, but I recently stumbled upon a great replacement for the Harry Potter series. Don't know if your boy has already devoured them, but the Artemis Fowl novels by Owen Colfer are an absolute blast.
He's a preteen criminal genius who plies his considerable intellect into criminal enterprises, beginning with one into the secret world of trolls and fairies. But over the course of the novels, Artemis grows up literally and figuratively, and you really get to see him gain his humanity and learn to take care of others.
Well, I'm afraid he said the magic words for Holden, trolls and fairies.
Trolls and fairies. I can second this, actually. They've been read and reread in our house by my fifth grade daughter, so I think Holden will need to get a hold of these.
Okay, recommended by the Larson family. I have two other recommendations tying in with show content. Last week on the show, when we did our top five films of 1981, Reds was my number two pick. John Reed, the main character of that Warren Beatty film, wrote 10 Days That Shook the World, Russia. Of course, his chronicle of the Russian Revolution from 1917, and that book is available for download from Audible. Also, looking ahead to some of our most anticipated fall movies, Ben Affleck's new movie Argo. You can read the book if you want to spoil the movie and read the book or have it read to you before it comes out. Argo, How the CIA and Hollywood Pulled Off the Most Audacious Rescue in History by Antonio Mendez and Matt Baglio. That book, also available from Audible. It's narrated by the fine, fine actor Dylan Baker. Another reason worth checking that out.
For a free audiobook of your choice, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. Baby, the moon. I must have loved 1,000 times, but there's a small town in my mind. How can I leave without hurting everyone that made me? Donnie, you're such a
Whoa, Elizabeth. A little hostile there. Maybe you should be the one in therapy, then Mom and Dad can pay someone $200 an hour to listen to all your thoughts, so we don't have to.
Okay. You want to tell Mom and Dad why you stopped taking your medication?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. And with respect to all of those October Sky fans out there, that's a scene from Donnie Darko, the film I would say that did launch Jake Gyllenhaal's career. Certainly the first time I remember being aware of him on screen.
You don't remember him from City Slickers?
No, I don't.
No, neither
I'm sorry,
do I, actually, but
he did have a role in that film, his first movie. Also in that scene with Jake Gyllenhaal is his sister, Maggie. And we're going to play a little battle of the Gyllenhaals as we get to our poll question here a little bit later in this segment. But right now it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, guest Michael Phillips helped us massacre this scene.
As you say, so many women and all these transformations and disguises he invents in order to seduce them, sometimes a shower of gold, a bull or a swan. Why, once he even tried to ravish me disguised as a cuttlefish.
Did he succeed?
Certainly not.
What did you do?
Beat him at his own game. I simply turned myself into a shark.
That's Claire Bloom, Maggie Smith, and I'm going to say the slightly less esteemed Susan Fleetwood from 1981's Clash of the Titans, directed by Desmond Davis, written by Beverly Cross.
Josh from Saskatoon wrote in with the tie-in. Imagine my surprise and delight when I heard you reciting one of my favorite films growing up, the immortal Clash of the Titans. Yes, it was campy and silly, and yes, the recent remake was a bastardization lacking any of the whimsy or joy of the original. But with a cast including Sir Laurence Olivier, Maggie Smith, and Burgess Meredith, how can you not consider this film a classic? The obvious tie-in is your top five list of films from 1981, but there is a tie-in with your review of Raiders of the Lost Ark as well. Both films are essentially plotted around a central quest for a certain item. In the case of Raiders, the Ark, and in Clash of the Titans, it's the head of the Gorgon.
Indeed. We have a few more tie-ins as well from listeners. Joshua Gall in Saratoga Springs, New York, says, though the obvious connection is the year, 1981, I would argue that the more interesting connection is that your visceral debate with Michael Phillips about Raiders of the Lost Ark was, in fact, a mind-boggling clash of the film titans,
wow,
akin to Perseus and his epic battles with Medusa and the Kraken. I don't know if I'd go that far, but thank you, Josh. Keep up the good work. Good luck rescuing Michael Phillips from the depths of Raiders' unappreciation, Josh says, lying somewhere across the River Styx at the outskirts of the underworld.
Yeah, I believe that's where he is right now. Shane Adam from Clayton, Victoria, Australia, also wrote in, another tie-in is that they share a beefy supporting star in Pat Roach. He was the muscle-bound Nazi that had an unfortunate run-in with a propeller in Raiders and the son of Zeus in Clash.
There's no way I would have ever put that together or known that if it wasn't for Shane Adams' email.
I don't like that.
No?
I want that's the kind of guy who can only be one character.
One guy, the
yeah,
Nazi.
Now that I know he's not really that Raiders character, I'm crushed.
Well, if you want to hear that top five, our favorite films of 1981, and our Raiders of the Lost Ark Sacred Cow discussion, you can get it at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. And Josh, I said that we were discussing Raiders of the Lost Ark because it had that IMAX re-release. It was 1 week only. It turns out, due to the big response, I'm sure it was due to our discussion that they are releasing the newly remastered Raiders of the Lost Ark for an extended theatrical run. It started this past Friday, so there's more than 300 digital theaters across the U.S. and Canada that are showing Raiders of the Lost Ark. If you haven't had a chance to see it on the big screen in a while, or maybe ever, now's your chance.
I'm sure Michael Phillips will be sitting in one of those theaters.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why don't you reach into the film spotting hat a little more brimming than last week, but still not as much as I would have expected for a quote-unquote classic like Clash of the Titans.
An immortal classic, yes.
Reach in and pick out this week's winner.
Winner is Dennis O'Hearn from Belchertown, Massachusetts.
Congratulations, Dennis. Email feedback@filmspotting.net. We'll set you up with your prize.
How did I come to this?
Not again.
I played Richard III.
Five curtain calls.
Five curtain calls. I was an actor once. Damn it, now look at me. Look at me! I can't go out there and I won't say that stupid line one more time.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
Well, we will give you a hint that this scene ties in directly to our top five this week, Los Angeles movies, but that's all you're getting. Josh, I don't know if you're ready for this.
I'm going to do my best, but
you're getting the tough part.
Yeah, it is befuddling me in advance, I'll say that.
Well, I think that you've proven yourself to be the Massacre Theater star since you joined the show.
Not great. Now I need more pressure. Thanks.
You certainly shine brighter than I do in my boring performances, so you're going to get the lead here. I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
Let's go.
And action.
May I offer you something to drink? A wine? A cocktail? A espresso?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
I make it myself right back here with a little lemon twist. It's good. Try it.
No, I'm fine.
I see you look at this piece.
Yeah, I was wondering how much something like this went for.
$103,000.
Get the F out of here.
No, I cannot. It's serious because it's a highly important piece.
Have you ever sold one of these?
Yes, I have for a collector.
Get the F out of here.
No, serious. I said it myself.
Scene. That was like a drunk Christopher Lloyd.
I don't know.
If
I have no explanation.
Latvia. I'm not sure what you were trying to do there, Josh.
That was exactly it.
I love it. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, September 25th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
If you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw, there it is. That's the straw, you see. Watching. My straw reaches across the room and starts to drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up!
Well, we go from that family-friendly performance from an L.A. movie for Massacre Theater to the decidedly unfamily-friendly Daniel Plainview from Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood. We were anticipating a discussion this week of Paul Thomas Anderson's new film, The Master. We were going to share our top five charismatic leaders. Obviously, we've just pushed that back a week. If you're out there freaking out that we didn't do that,
we'll get to it.
Chose to talk about End of Watch and our L.A. movies instead. We just had to postpone it a week. We will get to it next week. But in our poll question last week on the show, we were anticipating our PTA extravaganza, and we were thinking about some of his most memorable characters like Daniel Plainview, and there's really that element of salesmanship and charisma that comes through. So your question was, all these P.T. Anderson characters want to sell you something you don't need. Whom do you end up buying from? Your choices were, in the order they appear in PTA's filmography, Sidney from the movie Sidney or Heartache, Jack Horner, the director from Boogie Nights, Frank T.J. Mackey, Tom Cruise in Magnolia, Mattress Man Dean Trumbull from Punch Drunk Love, or is it Daniel Plainview from There Will Be Blood? Josh, how did it come out?
I'm kind of surprised by the last place finisher here. It's Sidney with only 7%.
You'd think you'd follow him.
Yeah.
He's such a nice guy.
Exactly.
And seems to really have your best interests at heart.
Pretty close there is Mattress Man Dean Trumbull, though, from Punch Drunk Love. He received 8%. Then in the middle, Frank T.J. Mackey from Magnolia with 12%. Jack Horner of Boogie Nights received 25%. And I think most people, like myself, were just scared of Daniel Plainview because he received 48% of the vote.
Yeah, that comes through in this comment from Art, who said, I only picked Daniel because he seems to scare me the most. If I ever met him on the street, I would do whatever he said just to get away from him. That's where you went in the poll, Josh. I went the same direction as James Gabriel, who wrote in and said, Jack Horner, he's selling porn, people. Porn. You buy from Plainview and you're getting a bowling pin to the melon.
The porn sold you, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. But something about Burt Reynolds as Jack Horner in that film, I think I would follow him anywhere. So that was a fun question. We appreciate everyone who voted in the poll. And again, we remind you, The Master and our top five charismatic leaders coming up next week on the show. Our current poll question, Josh, is one of our famous death matches here on Film Spotting. You got to pick one. Simple question. We give you two performers or two films. You got to pick your favorite. And thinking about Jake Gyllenhaal from the movie we discussed previously, End of Watch, we're curious, which one of the Gyllenhaal siblings are you partial to?
So the choices are Jake or Maggie here. And when I first read this, my instinct was Maggie, actually. For whatever reason, hearing about her being in a film sounds more promising than Jake. But then I look back at the films they've made and the performances that Jake has given, and you've got a lot of really good films mm-hmm. here. Brokeback Mountain, Zodiac, Moonlight Mile, I think he's really good in. I'll even defend Bubble Boy. So
wow.
Looking at all that, I got to go with Jake.
Yeah, I'm going with Jake, too. And I think it's just mainly a matter of timing. If we had had this poll question 2 years ago, Maggie in a walk for me, because there was a time on this show, Josh, where I actually think I had her as my number one lead actress of the year and my number one supporting actress of the year. Uh-huh. I went a little Maggie Gyllenhaal crazy a few years back. I think she's obviously tremendously talented, but if you look at her body of work recently,
right,
she really hasn't impressed me with some of her choices, but then I haven't enjoyed the performances either. I think of Crazy Heart, for example. I thought she was one of the weakest links in that film. So you couple her poor showing recently with the fact that Jake Gyllenhaal has genuinely become one of my favorite actors to watch on screen over the past 2 or 3 years because of performances like Source Code and Brothers and now End of Watch. It's definitely Jake for me, but I'm sure we're going to get some disagreement on that. We look forward to seeing your votes. You can do that now at filmspotting.net. Couple other quick notes. We did want to plug our appearance this weekend. If you're listening here on Friday, we're going to be appearing on the Late Live Show. This is Saturday, September 22nd, 8 p.m. More information about that show is available at thelateliveshow.com. And there's also a Film Spotting meetup going on around that, which you can learn more about in the Film Spotting forum. But this is a really fun show. I've been on it once before. Josh, your first time at the Late Live Show. We don't exactly know what questions they're going to pepper us with, but we're looking forward to it. And hopefully we'll see a lot of familiar faces there, or at least have some film spotting support. We hope you'll come out.
There is also a rumor going around Twitter that you'll be doing stand-up and I'll be juggling. I just wanted to say no juggling. I don't know about the stand-up. Maybe you're putting some stuff together.
I'm really just trying to get people curious. I was trying to,
and then they'll come and
tease them,
be waiting for the juggling and stand up.
Then they'll see that it's us sitting on a couch,
great,
being our normal pedantic, boring selves. But no, I think it's going to be a really good time, and hopefully we'll see some of you there. We also have a couple of contests we want to mention that we're really excited about. It's always fun to give away free movie passes.
Yeah, one of these we're giving away 40 admit to passes to an advanced screening of the found footage. There's more
found footage.
A horror film, VHS. That's going to be in Chicago on Monday, October 1 is the screening.
Yeah, there's an advanced screening of that. It opens, I believe, in theaters on the 5th, though it's also been available for a little while on demand. Ty West, the director behind The House of the Devil and the recent film The Innkeepers, is one of the directors who has a film in VHS. There are multiple short films. I know we have some horror buffs out there. If that's one you're interested in, go to filmspotting.net to get the information about how to enter that contest. We're also giving away 25 pairs of passes to see the new Channing Tatum film called 10 Years. It opens this weekend, and these are actually run of engagement passes. That means that you can use them anytime during its run here in Chicago. To enter that contest as well, all you got to do is visit filmspotting.net. It's really simple. You can find it there in the top story section of our site.
من فکر می‌کنم همینجا کافی باشه برای اون قصه که می‌خوایم بگیم. زن من تصور کنیم که این فرشه همسایه بغل دستی این کوچه پرست که الان آتش‌خال زیاده توش رفتن بیرون از این خونه وجود نداره.
That star Jafar Panahi in director Jafar Panahi's film This Is Not a Film that came out earlier this year, favorably reviewed on Film Spotting. It's a movie that largely inspired our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon, because after seeing it and the recent Best Foreign Language Film Oscar winner A Separation from director Asghar Farhadi, we recognize that contemporary Iranian cinema was a major hole for us. It was something that we wanted to fill. We wanted to catch up with some of these films and these directors who are not only making a name for themselves now, but have been making a name for themselves over the past decade or so on the international cinema scene. And that film also inspired the name for our awards. As we look back on the best of our six-film Iranian Cinema Marathon, we're calling it These Are Not Awards, Awards.
And I like it.
It speaks to not only the title, This Is Not a Film, but that's a movie where director Jafar Panahi is basically stuck. The government has said he can't make any more films. He's awaiting his sentencing for having violated some government rules on the types of films he should be making. And this is really his chance to try to tell the story he was going to tell as best he can inside his apartment, stuck inside his apartment. So it raises all these questions about what does constitute a movie. And as we saw with a lot of these films, there are a lot of meta narratives going on, stories within stories, sometimes even more stories within stories. It can be very complicated, but I know we found this marathon very, very rewarding. We saw six films overall: Close Up, A Moment of Innocence, Children of Heaven, The Mirror, Fireworks Wednesday, and Offside. We saw two films from Jafar Panahi and one film from Asghar Farhadi, who made A Separation, along with some other major luminaries in Iranian cinema. So Josh, let's start our awards with Best Supporting Performance.
Mine comes from Offside, actually, and the performer who I talked about when we reviewed the film originally, the lead guard who's in charge of the other soldiers who have corralled the women who are trying to sneak into this soccer stadium to watch the game. Now, I looked this up, and he's played either by, I feel really bad about this, but the way credits are listed, it's either Safdar Samandar or Mohammed Kher Abadi. And this character's arc goes from rigid rule follower to a puzzled rule questioner to an outright rule breaker by the end. And I really think that director Jafar Panahi means him to mirror the way he'd like to see Iranian society possibly move in understanding some of these rules and regulations. But this is a really good performance, too. I think the actor is probably one of the inexperienced performers that Panahi is using, but his emotions are really affecting on a bunch of different levels. Early on, you feel sorry for him when he's so befuddled about why these women are trying to do this and how is he going to get control of the situation. And then you really worry for him at one point when one of them escapes, and he goes on to say that if he loses this job or gets in trouble with the military, it's really going to ruin his family back home. And at the end, you just absolutely cheer for him. That moment we talked about where they're on the bus with his prisoners. He reaches his hand out the front to fix the radio antenna so they can all listen to the final moments of the game together. So just really affecting performance for me.
Yeah, that's a great one. Very good pick. My favorite supporting performance is going to Bahara Siddiqui. She is the little sister in the movie Children of Heaven. This is a film about a young boy and his sister, mainly focusing on the young boy who loses her shoes. They've been mended. It's her only pair of shoes. And they can't tell their parents, who are very poor, that they no longer have these shoes. And so the whole film is about the boy trying to find those shoes or find another pair of shoes, because what we see is otherwise they have to share that one pair of shoes. And I just love that dynamic with the two performers, Bahara Siddiqui, but also her brother, Amir Farouk Hashimian. They're very good together. Every time either one of them opens their mouth or their little eyes well up with emotion, it makes me well up with emotion. But I just love the dynamic between them and the fact that you do see those elements of siblings who squabble with each other and bicker with each other the way a brother and a younger sister would, but at the same time, they really understand their family dynamic. They really understand that they can't cause more strife for their parents who are already struggling, and they are in this together. So I just thought a very sweet performance, and I'm going with Bahara Siddiqui from Children of Heaven. What about your favorite performance from an actress?
From an actress, I'm going to actually go with Mina Mohammad Khani in The Mirror. And I know I've made those sort of boorish complaints about her voice and her screeching. And it's true. That was really off-putting. But that said, think about how she absolutely carries this movie at the age of, what, maybe seven, something like that. I'm not exactly sure. There are so many levels to this performance. Even if she didn't fully understand all of the ones that are going on, she manages to pull it off. And beyond all that, her performance is crucial because she's got to sell us in many different narratives that this kid would actually do all this, be this brazen. And this kid is such a spitfire that you completely buy it.
الان مطمئنی که درست سوار شدی؟
مطمئنم، زبان به مامانم همینجا نشسته بودی. نزدیک بود دست دوب کنید.
Well, I'm really shocked because I thought for sure that after all of the insults you hurled at that poor actress's voice, I didn't think there was any way you would give your favorite lead performance to her, but I'm really glad that you did. Obviously, I love that movie. For me, though, I'm cheating, Josh. I can't help it. It's not the end of the year. I can get away with it with Marathon Awards. I can't pick between the two main actresses in Fireworks Wednesday. No, I don't feel any shame about it.
You have to pick.
I'm not picking. Tarana Aladusti and Hedya Tarani, they are the two women in Fireworks Wednesday who are at the complete opposite ends of the marriage spectrum. The one woman who the relationship with her husband seems to be at its end. She suspects him of having an affair. They're fighting all the time. And you really start to almost resent her, where you think she's making things up. You think that maybe she's going crazy. And over the course of the film, you start to view her a little differently. You see that there is some validity to her concerns, and there's a lot more nuance there to that performance. You start to feel a lot of sympathy for her. And on the opposite end is the younger woman who is ready to embrace marriage, who's in love and can't wait to embark on her new life. And those two performances are just too good. I have to name them both.
That's fine, but I'm going to give Best Picture to four of these six films.
That's fine.
I hope that's okay with you.
If you want. What about favorite actor in the marathon?
I'm going to stick with Fireworks Wednesday, actually, and go with Hamid Farrakhanzad, who plays the husband, the deceptive husband. I know you're worried about giving too much away here, but really the levels of duplicity he's working within are key to what makes this such a good performance. He has the angry denials to his wife that he's involved with this other woman. That's one way he's being deceptive, and we see him in those scenes. He also complains to his coworker that his wife is crazy. And then there's the scene, the really moving scene towards the end, where he's in the car with his mistress and she's telling him it's time to move on. We've got to move on with our lives. And he's begging her to stay. And right there, he's deceiving himself. And so it's really a layered performance that Farrakhanzad is giving.
Yeah, I think he's very good in that film. But I'm going to go with Hossein Sabzian from Abbas Kiarostami's Close Up, the first film in our marathon, and such an interesting performance because he's a guy who is playing himself in this crazy meta narrative, and he's having to explain something that seems completely unexplainable, which is why he would pretend to be the director, Mohsen Makhmalbaf, who we saw in A Moment of Innocence, his film there, the second movie in our marathon. And he's a character that I think early on is a little bit hard to sympathize with because he's so aloof and because he's someone who doesn't seem to be able to articulate exactly what motivated him. But as the film goes on and he does try to explain himself, that's where I really did start to feel a connection to him as a character and started to understand, I think, how his mind was working a little bit. And it'd be easy to write him off not only as crazy, but also as maybe just slow, because he seems so detached sometimes from his circumstances and so unable to express himself. But that does change as the film goes on. It's a very layered performance, and I wanted to give Close Up some love here as we reflect back on the best of our contemporary Iranian cinema. We're calling these awards the These Are Not Awards, and I think that segues nicely, Josh, into our next category, which is our favorite meta moment from this marathon. As we said before, a lot of cases in these movies, in this marathon, that called attention to themselves as films, definitely breaking the fourth wall, having those multiple narratives going on within one larger narrative. So what was your favorite meta moment?
It has to be the mirror, right? And I know you feel like I've already given too much away, so I won't detail anything else except to say that when this movie changes into another movie, the moment that happens is my meta moment.
Yeah, it's mine as well. I'll give you the quote. It's simply, I'm not acting anymore. I'm not acting anymore is my favorite meta moment from this marathon. Two more These Are Not Awards to get to. Our favorite moment or scene?
I went with the flower in the sunlight in A Moment of Innocence. In this scene, there's a young actor who's acting. He's playing a part in a film, and he's supposed to give this flower to the girl in this story. But a funeral passes by him in the corridor he's standing in. And so he sets the flower down where it will rest in just this little slice of sun so that he can help carry the coffin. Then he comes back a bit later and it's gone. So he asks a passerby, have you seen a ray of sunlight? Because in the time, the sun has moved, and that was his marker. And the person just responds, the sun doesn't stay in one place. And I just love the mixture of documentary, meta-ness, but also poetry in that moment.
Yeah, that's a great pick. And certainly for me, I could have gone with my favorite meta moment as my favorite moment from this marathon. But I think there is one moment that had an even bigger impact on me and I think sums up this entire marathon. It's also from A Moment of Innocence. And I don't want to give it away because I want people to see this film if they haven't had a chance yet. But it's the final shot, the final freeze frame of A Moment of Innocence. And a lot of times there are certain filmmakers where the phrase humanism will come up. And I don't know that you get a more humanist moment than that final shot of this film. It's a transcendent moment where a filmmaker is using art to take a traumatic event from the past and right the wrong. And not only does he pull it off, but it takes us completely by surprise. At least it took me completely by surprise. You know that two characters are heading to a climactic moment, and the only way you think this can end is in a negative way. Maybe not the exact same way it ended 17 years ago or whatever they're reenacting, but there's no way this is going to go well. And then somehow, Mukmal Buff pulls it off. He shocks you and really moved me as well as I saw that final freeze frame of A Moment of Innocence. That brings us to our final award, Best Picture. Josh, where are you going?
I'm going with Close Up. And I'm choosing this because of the way it made me comfortable with this explosion of categories that really all of these films have done. I usually want to know what I'm watching. I want to be able to say, okay, I'm going to go see a documentary, or I'm going to go see a drama, or whatever it might be. And it's not just that Close Up mixes genres or methods of filmmaking, but it's the way it made me realizing that this mixing doesn't really matter. Because what these movies are going after is some sort of elemental truth. And they go about it in many different ways, all in one film. The truth of Close Up, I found to be that art and cinema in particular can exert this powerful pull on us to the point where it can meld with our own identities. And Abbas Kiarostami gets at this in a number of different ways. We have the trial footage of Sabzian, the character you mentioned, and this is very objective information in a lot of ways. So that's one tool. Then we have Sabzian's performance, which I agree is central to this film. And whether you believe this is reenacting, acting, or something in between, it definitely gives that emotional appeal that we're used to from dramas. And then there are just the extraneous bits. I mentioned the windshield shot, where we just get lost in the pure aesthetic beauty of bouncing light and reflecting images. These are communicating the visceral appeal of the art form, and that's just some sort of artistic enchantment working on me. So all of this is coming together, and I guess it just reiterated to me not to worry so much about what I'm watching, but what it's doing, which was really magical.
Yeah, Close Up really is a wonderful film, along with A Moment of Innocence. Those are my two favorites other than the film that is getting my award. Of course, it is The Mirror. And I don't really want to say anything more about it. As I've been dancing around a little bit, I still want people to see this movie if they haven't had a chance and come to it as fresh as they can, because there is kind of a narrative surprise that happens in the film, and it really pays off. The Mirror, for me, I said it when we discussed it, is one of my biggest discoveries in the history of the show. Over 7.5 years, and in doing 22 or 23 marathons or whatever it's been, it's up there with the top one or two movies that really took my breath away and really made me so grateful that I embarked on this marathon. So The Mirror for me is a slam dunk winner of my These Are Not Awards award for Best Picture. And one of the things that was really fun to watch happen after our discussion, and if you want to hear our discussion, I encourage you to go to the marathons link at filmspotting.net or find Filmspotting at iTunes. It's show number 407. I really get into a lot more detail about why I love the movie so much. But seeing on Twitter various listeners who after that show were pointing out how they were rushing to Netflix to try to get a copy of The Mirror to see it, and it was a short wait, and then it was a long wait. It went from being completely available, no one cared about this movie for a long time, all of a sudden, I can honestly say that because of this show, we were both very positive on the film, people were going to Netflix in droves. It caused the movie to go into long wait mode. I just discovered today, though, Josh, that the whole movie is streaming on YouTube.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you can't get it from Netflix or you don't want to wait for the disc, you can watch the entire movie, The Mirror, on YouTube.
Maybe you force Netflix to buy a whole bunch of copies of The Mirror. That would be great.
Maybe so. And it really is just great to know that we are having some impact here with these discussions. That closes out our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon. And I touched on this a week or two ago, Josh, that while this marathon wasn't overly heavy, wasn't overly depressing, at the same time, you're dealing with some serious subject matter in many of these films, not to be taken lightly. It's challenging, stimulating stuff. And that's following our Robert Bresson marathon, right, where I was just considering this today. If you take Diary of a Country Priest, Mouchette, Alhazar Balthazar, those movies might actually be the saddest, most depressing
good times ever made.
I mean, really, it doesn't get any darker and bleaker.
Did you leave out Balthazar?
No, I said it.
Oh, okay.
And it doesn't get any darker than those movies. So it's going to be so fun to go from the heaviness of Bresson and Iranian cinema to our next two marathons, Blaxploitation, gearing us up for Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's new film, and following that, The Marx Brothers.
Just going to lose all credibility going
basically
from those two to these two.
I love it. You got to mix it up, Josh. And we have preliminary lineups at filmspotting.net if you click on the marathons, but they are nowhere set in stone. I think The Marx Brothers is probably pretty well set going with the movies that most people identify as their most important, but Blaxploitation, you can go so many different directions, and we obviously are not experts when it comes to this genre. We're going to rely on many of you to help us pick the 5 or 6 films that we want to watch as part of this marathon. So if you've got ideas, this is a genre you know well, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We'll definitely take everything you say into consideration.
Alvy Singer described Los Angeles as a place where the only cultural advantage is being able to make a right turn on a red light. We'll see if LA has more to offer in the Film Spotting Top 5 next. Stay with us.
It's thank you time here on Film Spotting, the part of the show where we say thanks to our very generous listeners who support the show by sending in some of their hard-earned cash. We also want to thank Jeff Goldsmith from the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, his podcast where he largely interviews screenwriters but also has on directors and actors. You can get it by doing a search for the Q&A in iTunes. Also in iTunes, you can find his iPad app, Backstory. Let's get to our donors with a very generous donation from a new $10 a month subscriber.
Yeah, big thanks to Greg in Overland Park, Kansas.
We also have a brand new $5 a month subscriber.
That would be Maggie in Broadlands, Virginia.
We have two new Silver Club donors to Film Spotting. We start with Amy in New York City.
My fiancé Sean and I are preparing for our wedding in November, and we love to watch movies and listen to Film Spotting together. We're making this donation and mailing an invitation to our wedding in New York as thanks for the many hours of movie discussion and viewing pleasure you've inspired over the years. Thanks for making our favorite podcast. We look forward to many years of excellent movies, engaging conversation, and wedded bliss.
That's very sweet. We wish you guys all the best. And if we actually do get that invitation, I haven't checked the P.O. box in a while. We're coming.
Are we? You're committing us. You're RSVP now.
I hope you know that we're coming. And it should be a good time. I've been looking for a reason to get to New York City. So, Amy and Sean, you've given it to me. Ben in Sydney, New South Wales, Australia, also writes in.
I was pleased to be able to finally donate to your show this week, especially considering it is long overdue. I've been listening to your podcast for years, ever since the No Country for Old Men episode, and it keeps me occupied in the hours driving to and from set in Sydney and Melbourne, where I work as a camera assistant in film and TV. I'm also raising funds for a short film that I'm making at the end of the year. Contributors can donate online.
Ben says, perhaps you can link to it in the show notes in case any of the Film Spotting community might have some money cluttering up their house that they just don't need. There's a video there where they can see a little more about the project and what we're trying to achieve. So we definitely support all of our filmmakers out there and aspiring filmmakers in the Film Spotting audience, and we will put that link in our show notes. Four other donors we are very grateful for, starting with Nathan R. in London and Alex in Cottage Grove, Wisconsin. Also, Jack from Film Spotting East, Arlington, Virginia. He has some thoughts on some of the recent humor that's come through on the show, Josh, since you joined. He's a big fan of the dynamic lately, says we've conjured up some real gems that warrant at least 50 cents a show.
Wow. Well, Exhibit A and B are both from episode 403, he says. I was riding DC's crowded metro when Josh explained that it was that time of the month for Tyler Perry's next film. I tried to hold in my laughter, only to hear Michael Phillips deem La Grande Illusion a total piece of shit. At that point, I lost it, eliciting stares from my fellow commuters. But don't feel left out, Adam. Your recent retort to Josh's brief review of AI, incorrect, is one of the best moments in the show's history. Keep it up, guys. You make my week.
It's kind of a shorter version of, I hear what you're saying, but you're completely wrong. I'm just saying you're wrong. Incorrect.
And it has totally made me rethink AI completely.
I'm sure.
Yes.
I'm sure. It was very damaging to your take on that film. Thank you, Jack. We close with this one from William in Parry Sound, Ontario. That's in Canada.
Just got back from the Toronto International Film Festival. Had a really good time. I got to meet Edward Burns after his film The Fitzgerald Family Christmas. Great movie and a great guy. Here's my top 10 list of the festival. 10 would be Francis Ha. 9, Cloud Atlas. 8, Silver Linings Playbook. 7, End of Watch.
There it is.
6, The Fitzgerald Family Christmas. 5, The Hunt. 4, Disconnect. 3, The Impossible. 2, The Perks of Being a Wallflower. And his number one film was Argo. Says, hope to see you guys there next year. Oh,
man,
it's always rubbing it in.
That would
be
great. It's been a while. It's been at least 3 years since I've been to Toronto. And as I keep saying, unfortunately, here on the show, I'm just not sure when my schedule is going to allow me to go back. I'd love for us to go sometime, Josh. We do need to make that or some other film festival happen. And I think we will pull that off here at some point. Thanks again to William and all of our generous donors.
Hey, I'm Ellen Page.
And I'm Diablo Cody.
We are the actor and writer of the film Juno, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Gonna be a lot of irate citizens when they find out that they're paying for water that they're not gonna get.
Oh, that's all taken care of. See, Mr. Gibbs, either you bring the water to L.A., or you bring L.A. to the water.
How are you gonna do that?
By incorporating the valley into the city. Simple as that.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's Noah Cross and Jake Gittes from one of the all-time great films, Chinatown. Maybe the all-time greatest L.A. movie as well. And that's the Film Spotting Top 5 this week. Los Angeles movies, tying in with our discussion earlier in the show of the new LAPD cop movie, End of Watch. Chinatown, however, Josh. one of your all-time favorite films, made your top 10 Sight and Sound, and maybe for me was my number 11 or 12. I love it that much. Hard to leave out of the top 10. Not going to be eligible for these lists because it's in the film spotting pantheon.
And rightly so.
And rightly so. It's in that group of films that we just love so much, they'd appear in pretty much every top five if we didn't make them exempt.
We'd find a way to put them in.
We had to put them aside. So that's where Chinatown is. Another great L.A. movie you're not going to hear in our top five, The Big Lebowski, also in the film spotting pantheon. So, Josh, what was eligible and how did you form your top five LA movies?
It was pretty simple for me, actually. I didn't want the city to be just a setting, but I wanted it to be essential to the story or have a significant influence on the story. We also did set aside Hollywood movies, we should note, too, because that's just its own category completely.
It is.
So the industry, anything to do with Hollywood and the movies, we put aside.
And obviously that's hard to do in many ways, right or wrong. L.A. is synonymous with Hollywood, and you think of the movie business, but we thought that's already a top five we've done, and we really did want to focus on L.A. as a city, aside from its role in showbiz. So movies like Mulholland Drive, A Star is Born, Sunset Boulevard, In a Lonely Place, Barton Fink, we could go on and on. Even for me, films like Swingers and Drive that aren't really about the making of movies or about Hollywood films, but nevertheless have those components to it, those aren't eligible. In Swingers, they're aspiring actors. In Drive, he's a stuntman. So we tried to overlook any film that had that Hollywood element to it as we formed our top five LA movies. So what's your number five?
Die Hard on a Bus. I went with Speed. Now, the reason I picked it, though, for the LA movie is because there's an ironic Los Angeles joke at the heart of this thing that anything could possibly travel this fast along Los Angeles's roadways. I mean, traffic jams are everywhere. We all deal with them, but they're especially omnipresent in L.A. because of the sprawling nature of the city. So seeing a bus careen across town really has an extra kick for anyone who's lived there or spent a significant amount of time there. I do think this is a superior action film as well, though, in the way it does something with its studio one-sentence pitch conceit. Not only is the Die Hard on the Bus concept sustained, but director Jan de Bont turns the middle section into perhaps the purest action film ever made. If you could just take that middle part, I mean, it really is just pure speed. Unfortunately, the final third is kind of the movie's own sorry sequel, takes into the subway. That's not very L.A. at all. I don't know if anyone even knows L.A. has a subway system, but at least up until that point, it's a defining L.A. film for me.
Okay. You've convinced me on Speed. I definitely can see it as a great L.A. movie. Not only do we have two movies in the pantheon, though, I wanted to put two movies in the film spotting penalty box. These are films that should probably be in the pantheon but aren't quite there yet, and they've just come up so much on the show that I didn't want to rehash a lot of what I've said, especially recently. I've talked plenty about Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity, but an all-time great L.A. film, and I will have a comment on that later. Also, Pulp Fiction. There are a lot of Tarantino ways you could go with this list, but that's a big one that we've talked about recently on the show. We discussed it as a sacred cow. We did our Pulp Fiction top five memorial dance scenes recently, so let's just put that one aside as well. And that brings me to my number five, which I really have to thank one of our longtime listeners for, Sean Gilman. He's kind of the dean of the Film Spotting Forum and a new member to the Film Spotting Advisory Board, the listener volunteers who help us out coming up with top five lists and topics like this. He suggested that we had to see this video essay, really, this documentary called Los Angeles Plays Itself. And it's so good. It's really so amazing. It should be my number one. It'd be hard to come up with a better film that captures what LA is on screen than this documentary. The only reason I'm putting it at number five, Josh, is because I'm going to reference it 100 times as I go through the rest of my list. It's pretty much unavoidable. But Tom Anderson is an instructor at CalArts, or at least he was back when he was making this film. It came out in 2003, and it truly is the definitive comprehensive look at L.A. in the movies. And part of his endeavor with this project seems to be to reclaim L.A. as a city, as a great city, to not just talk about it in terms of what it means to the movie business, but how it should be up there in discussions with New York City and Paris and London and Chicago as a great city. And he's critical of some films and how they portray L.A. on screen. He even gets into some of the specifics of the architecture and how certain movies seem to really go after certain architects in particular and how their homes come across, how they're portrayed on screen. He also gets into the illusory nature of the city, how hard it is just to photograph.
Los Angeles may be the most photographed city in the world, but it's one of the least photogenic. It's not Paris or New York. In New York, everything is sharp and in focus. as if seen through a wide-angle lens. In smoggy cities like Los Angeles, everything dissolves into the distance, and even stuff that's close up seems far off.
This film is a really fascinating piece of extended video criticism. He shows you all the different ways that certain landmarks have been portrayed on screen. LAX, Union Station, the Bradbury Building, Ennis House. These are going to come up again as we go through my list. And he talks about how unique the terrain of LA is, where it can be anywhere and anything. So many movies are shot in LA and meant to be LA, but also sometimes they are shot there but meant to be somewhere else entirely, because you've got lakes and hills and valleys and urban settings and farmland. You can't say the same about Chicago, for example. You know a film right when you see it. It's Chicago. With LA, it can really be so many different places. I promise one line, at least, Josh, about Double Indemnity. He devotes a little section of Los Angeles Plays Itself to Double Indemnity, and he actually quotes someone who said, "You could charge LA as a co-conspirator in the crimes this movie relates." So a lot of respect for how Billy Wilder portrays LA in Double Indemnity, but Los Angeles Plays Itself, I can't recommend it highly enough, and the whole film is available in parts on YouTube, so you can go watch it right now.
I did see that suggestion, wasn't able to catch up with it myself, so I'm glad it made your list. When I was putting my list together, it seemed to me that a lot of movies about sleaze and corruption, for some reason, kept coming up. I don't know if that's some sort of commentary, not just the movies about the movies, but just other LA films had sleaze and corruption.
Oh, absolutely.
So I don't know if that was a commentary on the movie business without naming the movie business. But my representative picture for this group is going to be 1946's The Big Sleep from director Howard Hawks. Stars Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart. This is where Bogart's playing the iconic Raymond Chandler detective Philip Marlowe. Now, the story is notoriously muddled. It's amusing how Wikipedia tries to handle this in their plot summary. They just say, "The plot of The Big Sleep is unusually complex. Some details remain hazy at the film's end." Yes, that's true. The story does start, though, with an L.A. millionaire hiring Marlowe to take care of some business involving his daughter. This leads to run-ins with drug addicts, nymphomaniacs, blackmailers, pornographers. Now, what really happens here doesn't ultimately matter. This isn't a picture about plot. It's really about tone, and it's the lurid, lewd language of Chandler and apparently Los Angeles, judging by the titles that I considered for my list.
Yeah, I think Chandler definitely has to come up in any discussion of Los Angeles, and The Big Sleep was a strong contender for my list. It's just off it, though, as an honorable mention. If you've seen The Big Lebowski and you love The Big Lebowski, but you haven't seen The Big Sleep, you really owe it to yourself to see what the Coen brothers are doing in terms of paying tribute and kind of aping a lot of what we see from Chandler and Howard Hawks in that film, The Big Sleep. Great pick. My number four is a movie that I don't think has come up at all, Josh, since you joined the show, and I'm going to announce it by just asking you this simple question. In one sentence or less, how do you feel about the Michael Mann film Heat?
I like it.
You like it?
Yeah.
Do you love it?
I'm not going to expand because I might be mentioning it later.
You might be.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Well, I asked you that because famously or infamously, your predecessor was not a big fan of Heat. And I love this film. And that produced an outpouring of emails saying Maddie was crazy, saying actually Maddie was right, and Adam, you're the one who's wrong for loving this film so much. So I want to know where you fell on this movie, but it's a film that came to mind right away when I was thinking of LA films because it shows so many different parts of LA and groups of people living in LA. I think of the helicopter scene with Al Pacino flying over that night skyline, seeing the entire city and flying over the expressway, the diners, the bookstores, the clubs, the Vincent Thomas Bridge, the view from Malibu, where Val Kilmer's character lives. And actually, last March, I think it was March 2011 here on the show, we revisited a top five here on Film Spotting, our top five heist movies. And we brought on a longtime LA resident, longtime Film Spotting listener and screenwriter named Brett Merriman. He called in to talk about why I was right, why Heat is such a good film.
You're still having this argument,
aren't
you?
Yes, I am. And here is one of the reasons Brett gave for loving Heat. He says, it's the real thing, to a fault. If it's not real, it won't be in Mann's movie. He thinks if the whole film is real, you might feel something real. My favorite, because I live in LA, in the movie, De Niro needs a book on stress fractures in titanium. Where does he go? Where I would go, the specialty bookstore Hennessy and Ingalls. Where does he eat afterwards? Some swanky restaurant 20 miles away? No, the deli 3 blocks away from the bookstore in real life. Mann spent the money to shoot in the real place so the actors and the audience would have an authentic experience. Thank you, Michael Mann. That's Brett Merriman on why Heat is great. And he's talking about the scene where he meets Amy Brenneman's character. Robert De Niro meets Amy Brenneman, develops a relationship with her, and we get that great scene on her patio looking out over the L.A. skyline as they get to know each other better.
City lights. In Fiji, they have these iridescent algae that come out once a year in the water. That's what it looks like out there.
You been there?
No, I'm going there someday.
Oh, yeah. You travel a lot?
Yeah.
Travel makes you lonely?
I'm alone. I am not lonely. You?
Well, Tom Anderson, the director of Los Angeles Plays Itself, would disagree with Brett Merriman a little bit in the authenticity that comes through in Heat, because he actually points out that in that scene, there's no way anyone making a bookstore clerk salary could have that view. Doesn't matter how small it is or how cramped she claims it is, how old it is. Nobody on her salary could afford that view. And also, there's a funny little moment where Rob De Niro is pointing out an escape route or something, and he looks at the Vincent Thomas Bridge and he calls it the St. Thomas Vincent Bridge, which actually isn't true. Thomas Vincent, not a saint. But those are some of the details that come through in Los Angeles Plays Itself. And I defended Pacino a few weeks ago for Scent of a Woman. Did I want to see as much Colonel Slade from that film in his character here, Vincent Hanna, as we ultimately get? No. I wish it was a little bit more of a subtle performance, but I really do think it's still a great performance, and we still get Al Pacino and Robert De Niro acting in a scene together, and that's worth it. I think Heat's a great film and a great L.A. film.
I would love to contradict you, but I'm afraid, yeah, I agree. Heat is a very good film. For my number three, might be cheating, possibly, because it feels more like Southern California than specifically L.A., but I think it counts. It's The Graduate. The reason I'm counting it is because two of the crucial ingredients for this film are pure L.A., pools and plastic. Probably the definitive scene here, for the L.A. category at least, is the one of Dustin Hoffman just drifting, as he puts it, in the pool. It's so visually perfect because the accusing glare of the sun is peeking over the shoulder of Benjamin's accusing father. And I think it really captures the ennui that is particular to youth. That is what The Graduate is mainly about, is this generational concern. But I think it also reflects the sense of disenchantment that permeates LA in general. Again, I think it's connected to the movie industry. Mm-hmm. So even though that's not what it's about, it's kind of what it's about.
Yeah, I'm not going to accuse you of cheating. In fact, I'm going to put The Graduate on my list at number three as well. I think you're absolutely right that it's hard not to look at this film and not see it through the prism of the Hollywood dream, the California dream anyway, and this notion that everything is open to you, you have all the opportunity in the world, and yet you can still have a character who is so totally disillusioned. So I think more than anything, it really taps in to that state of mind. And one of the things that comes through, you touched on the corruption that seems to come through in so many LA movies. In that documentary, Tom Anderson talks about the fact that because of the way LA's been portrayed on screen, it's become, to everybody else in the world, the capital of adultery and murders. And there is this notion that something is always a little sinister, that there's something dirty underneath the shiny surface. And here with The Graduate, it's hard to get shinier than that California sun beating down on Ben with his sunglasses laying in the pool, just drifting. As you said, the locations too, the college scenes, they're supposed to be Berkeley, but they're actually shot at USC. The hotel where he has his tryst with Mrs. Robinson, the old Ambassador Hotel where RFK was assassinated. And those scenes are Beverly Hills. The Beverly Hills homes that Benjamin and their WASP friends live in is the ritzy part of L.A. So I think The Graduate is undeniably a great L.A. film. What's your number two?
My number two is Boys in the Hood. And it was interesting to see End of Watch and this same South Central neighborhood, essentially, just a few decades later. South Central took on this mythic stature in the wake of John Singleton's 1991 debut, which was about a good kid played by Cuba Gooding Jr., who was navigating his way through this crime-ridden neighborhood. The movie does get messagey in the end, I'll admit that. I think of Ice Cube's voiced wondering why America don't know, don't show, or don't care about what's going on in the hood. But nevertheless, the movie did end up correcting just this sort of ignorance. And it did this by really being a portrait of a community. So instead of showing how crime is just an issue of good guys versus bad guys, we get a sense of the complicated mixture of rivalries, family ties, misplaced loyalties and all sorts of frustrations and all these being overheated by this oppressive poverty. So Boys in the Hood did mean to be a wake-up call to America, and it was in a lot of ways, not least of which was this wake-up call in terms of how the rest of the nation thought of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Turned on the TV this morning. Had this shit on about living in a violent world. Showed all these foreign places foreigners living on. Started thinking, man, either they don't know, don't show, or don't care about what's going on in the hood.
I love Boys in the Hood. That was definitely an honorable mention for me. My number two is a movie that Tom Anderson describes as the L.A. movie of the 80s, which is interesting. Of course, it was made in the 80s, and I think everyone thinks of it as perhaps the definitive film about L.A. that came from that decade, even though it's set in the future. And that's one of the reasons I have it so high. It's Ridley Scott's movie Blade Runner. And it does take so many of those commonly used L.A. movie locations again and again, they've been in other films, but transforms them, makes them almost unrecognizable from those other movies. And I'm going to actually quote a little bit here from a website. There's a movie locations website that focuses on L.A. in particular and shows where a lot of these famous films were shot. And they talk about the polluted, rain-swept, orientalized Los Angeles futurescape that's provided the pattern for countless dystopian fantasies is the old Warner's backlot gangster street transformed with miles of neon and acres of glass. The cop station of the future, the police house there where Deckard is hauled to, is actually an office set built within the Union Station. The home of the toy maker Sebastian in the movie is the Bradbury Building. And if you don't know the Bradbury Building when I say it, it's from the end of 500 Days of Summer. It's where Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character goes and has a job interview in those staircases. Very memorable. Been in so many movies. His apartment building is the Ennis Brown House. It was a Frank Lloyd Wright built house that is commonly used in movies to signify the villain's cold, sleek home, the rich guy who's corrupt and the puppet master pulling all the strings with everything that's going wrong in L.A. That's the Ennis House, and they completely turn it into this apartment building where he actually lives, Harrison Ford's character in that film. So I think really the way it looks so recognizably L.A., but then takes those things that we recognize as L.A. and then just subverts them a little bit or alters them to make them new, make them appear like something we're seeing for the first time is really something that Ridley Scott pulls off with that movie.
Yeah, I think it's the distinguishing characteristic of that as a sci-fi film really is taking, it's not just the future city, but this familiar future city. Great pick. I'm going to return to our Heat discussion a little bit for my number one, because I actually went with Collateral.
Wow.
I did think about Heat, but it's a little bit to do with what you talked about with Pacino's performance. I feel like the focus in Heat is on De Niro and Pacino, while the focus in Collateral is on the particularly Los Angeles glow of fluorescent lights. That's almost the subject of the film. It is Michael Mann's less heralded 2004 effort in which Tom Cruise is a professional killer. He kidnaps a cabbie, played by Jamie Foxx, and forces him to drive around L.A. for a night of hits. You can pick up on some of the Taxi Driver vibes here, and certainly the attention man gives to the glowing streetlights and the garish signs is inspired by the Scorsese classic. As you mentioned with Heat, almost all of Mann's films, as you talked about, could be described as love affairs with nocturnal landscapes, and this one, with the cinematography by Dion Beebe, would be foremost among them in my mind, at least. I think most telling is that as good as Cruise and Foxx are, and I really like them both in this picture, when I hear this title, I think of the bright lights of this West Coast big city first.
How long do you think this will take?
7 minutes.
Seven. Not eight, not six.
2 minutes to get across the 110 to Normandy, Normandy to Venice, 3 minutes. Over the Union is one, plus one happened.
Okay, have I time you?
Knock yourself out.
What do I get if you're wrong? Free ride?
You get an apology. I already offered him my free ride today.
To who?
Some girl.
Did you get a date with her?
First time in L.A.?
Nah. Tell you the truth, whenever I'm here, I can't wait to leave. It's too sprawled out, disconnected. You know, that's me. You like it?
It's my home.
Well, you know why Collateral is less heralded than other Michael Mann efforts?
Don't even say it's a
bad
film.
Because it's not very good.
Oh, my. Well, you want to have your man argument. It'll be over Collateral.
It will be over Collateral because that was a movie I was so underwhelmed by. for so many reasons, though. It belongs in any conversation about L.A. films. I'll give you that. It definitely uses the environment. It uses the cityscape in interesting ways. Michael Mann knows what he's doing with the camera, but narratively, that film doesn't do anything for me. So I'm kind of surprised that it's your number one, frankly.
I'm giving it because it's doing exactly what Heat missteps, is puts the focus on the performances and becomes this showy, big...
There are no missteps with Heat.
No missteps. You yourself talked about Pacino's performance.
I like his performance. Ultimately, I like his performance. I wish it was a little more distinct from his Son of a Woman performance, but it's still really good.
I mean, I like Heat. I'm not gonna rip on Heat, but Collateral's just so much more artful and subtle to me.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll go to my number one. You had some love for Raymond Chandler and The Big Sleep in your top five. I'm going with a Raymond Chandler adaptation for my number one. It is Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye from, I believe, 1973. And one of the really interesting points that Tom Anderson makes in Los Angeles Plays Itself is he talks about the sense of nostalgia that is inherent with almost every L.A. movie, that so many movies set in L.A. are actually period pieces because there's always this notion that there was a better time. And I think that actually speaks to, as well, this illusory quality of Hollywood. It's part of that dream. It's what keeps people coming to Hollywood, this notion that things were once great, and even if they aren't great right now, they could be great again. So it keeps perpetuating that myth. And what Robert Altman does is he kind of plays with that myth in The Long Goodbye. He says, okay, you want nostalgia. What happens here when Raymond Chandler's private detective, Philip Marlowe, basically falls asleep for 30 years and wakes up now in the 1970s instead of the 1940s? And now L.A. is a place of quack therapists, of two-bit corrupt movie producers, corrupt cops, alcoholic authors in their gated communities and their beach homes, naked women getting high and exercising or meditating or doing whatever they're doing right outside his window. This is, to some extent, that red light cultural landscape that Woody Allen jokes about in Annie Hall. It's very intense. The cinematography, because of some of the things they do in post-production, it makes the light very overwhelming and blinding and very white. But this is a place that is intense, but ultimately totally devoid of substance. It's completely superficial. And I actually want to close with a quote I found in an article about The Long Goodbye where the author says, this is L.A., but it is emphatically Altman's L.A., a melange of exotic has-beens in a desolate cultural landscape. If the Marlowe of old had raged against an L.A. that was too often heartless, this Marlowe can only shrug at a new L.A. that is simply spineless, gutless, and bloodless. I think that sums it up perfectly. So The Long Goodbye is a movie I could go on and on about, actually discussed here on the show during our new Hollywood marathon back in 2008, I believe. But that's a movie that every time I see it is more rewarding. So it's my number one L.A. movie. What about honorable mentions, Josh?
I did consider Blade Runner, which you had on your list. I also wanted to give an honorable mention to Killer of Sheep, which is a 1977 feature from the often unheralded indie director Charles Burnett. It's about a slaughterhouse worker in Watts. I've only seen parts of this, so I couldn't really put it on my list, but it well deserves attention. Terminator 2. Was close, just because
Terminator as well is an L.A. movie.
Yeah, but in Terminator 2, have those viaducts in L.A. ever been so well used? I also gave thought to The Kids Are All Right, Shortcuts, speaking of Altman, To Live and Die in L.A., and then a pair from Steve Martin, L.A. Story and Shop Girl.
Yeah, Shop Girl is a film I actually really appreciated when we reviewed it here on the show a few years ago, and I've never seen all of L.A. Story, maybe one I need to catch up with. For me, not only did I consider The Big Sleep and Boys in the Hood, as I mentioned, but Mildred Pierce was a tough one to leave out, the Michael Curtiz movie, Magnolia from Paul Thomas Anderson, To Live and Die in L.A., the William Friedkin film, L.A. Confidential, how about that great film that hasn't come up yet in this entire segment? I also like Shortcuts. I also like Devil in a Blue Dress, which is a movie I seem to like a lot more than most people do.
No, that's
Denzel Washington movie, the Carl Franklin film. But it's a great pairing in some ways with Boys in the Hood because it is that South Central neighborhood, but back in the 50s, post-war, when it's bustling and middle class
and
gorgeous. And you really get to see that in a completely different way. I also have to mention, as cheesy as it is, a movie that uses L.A. really well is the Charlton Heston movie from the 70s, The Omega Man, where he's the last man on earth, has L.A. all to himself. It is a crazy, corny, campy film. But just seeing him driving through those desolate streets and going to movie theaters and having L.A. all to himself abandoned really does qualify it for this discussion.
Sadly, I've not seen Omega Man. No. I don't know how I've lived.
It's not that sad. But those are our top five Los Angeles movies. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Dread 3D, The House at the End of the Street, the horror movie with one of our favorites here, Jennifer Lawrence, and The Trouble with the Curve, the new Clint Eastwood film with Amy Adams, as well, and End of Watch, the new film from David Ayer, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena as two LAPD cops. A little bit split on that one. We recognized a lot of the same things that maybe didn't work with the film, but I'm a little more positive than you are, Josh. In limited release, 10 Years, the new high school reunion movie with Channing Tatum. Liberal Arts, a film that opened on demand last weekend. Josh Radner, the star and director of that film. It's opening in theaters here in Chicago. Also, the documentary How to Survive a Plague, which is the story of ACT UP and TAG, the two coalitions that were really vital in the battle against AIDS. Also, of course, The Master. It's been out in New York and L.A. It hits Chicago and other screens this weekend. Next week on the show, we will review The Master.
Is that a promise?
It's
now
a promise.
All right.
And share our top five charismatic movie leaders. And we hope to have a review as well of Rian Johnson's new film, Looper, which opens on the 28th. Josh has had a chance to see it. I have not seen Looper yet, and it all depends on whether or not there's another screening to see that in advance. But you can rest assured that we will definitely review Looper at some point on the show.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was Regina Spector. You can learn more at reginaspector.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.